Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 954. Syrian chemical weapons attack? Not so fast. This is being recorded on April 13th of the year 2017. The situation in Syria, obviously, and the Middle East as a whole, is escalating in tone, substance, and perhaps even more in possibilities. And things don't look real good. Our media have exercised almost no critical capability in assessing the government claims. The U.S. government claims that the Syrian government decided to smash itself in the face with a strategic cream pie by attacking a rebel city with sarin nerve gas. This is exactly what the opposition would want because it signaled a increased U.S. involvement with the rebel cause, although Trump also says it is going to be limited. We'll see what happens. That may mean a no-fly zone. It may mean bombing. We'll see. We should note that with that one step, the Trump administration has neutralized the Trump as Putin puppet meme, and that's just what it is that has become sort of accepted political thought in this country. Things have reached a really, if it weren't so grotesque and if the possibilities weren't so dangerous, it would be genuinely funny. We now learn that Comey's FBI was investigating Trump as early as July of last year. Comey failed to make mention of that, however. And with Comey's FBI at the core of not only the Russians did the high-profile hacks, which, as I've covered in numerous shows, just won't hold up under scrutiny. And with Comey's FBI now accusing Russia or being the point element in accusing Russia of interfering in U.S. elections on behalf of Trump, well, it has reached the state of high comedy with Comey's FBI accusing Russia of having interceded on behalf of the Trump campaign. It's rather like a syphilitic whore lecturing on the methodological discipline and virtues of celibacy. Obviously, Comey's FBI intervened directly on behalf of the Trump campaign, and with its last little entry a couple of weeks before the election itself, in which Comey announced that once again there were emails that were being scrutinized to see if Hillary Clinton had put classified information in them, that just a couple of weeks before the election. It may very well have been the decisive factor in what was a very close election with some 77,000 votes having decided the issue. Why Assad would have basically done exactly what he should not have done is, for any objective observer, a dominant factor to be weighed. There are all sorts of fantastic hypotheses coursing through the American media. They are, however, I think, altogether dubious. One of the things that has not received the coverage due it is the fact, and we have covered this in many other programs, that the area in which the alleged sarin strike by the Syrian forces took place is al-Nusra country. Al-Nusra is al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria. Basically, it is a direct branching off. It is a branch of al-Qaeda, which in turn is something of a subsidiary combatant organization of the Muslim Brotherhood. Something that I think in many ways frames the grotesque nature of what we have arrived at is the fact that a top Saudi cleric who is working with the al-Nusra Front, again, that's al-Qaeda in Iraq when it is in Syria, and that has been a major element of the anti-Assad rebels. That cleric is a fellow who was trained by another Saudi cleric who helped to train and minister to some of the 9/11 hijackers. So in effect, what we have is the State Department and the U.S. military conducting strikes on behalf of al-Qaeda. Some background to that from Alternet of April 5th of 2017, an article by Max Blumenthal and Ben Norton. Is Trump rescuing al-Qaeda's heartland in Syria? It reads in part, "We have not yet any official or reliable confirmation," unquote, "of what took place or who was responsible for it," said the U.N. Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, at a press conference after the incident. "We also do not have evidence at the moment," added Federica Mogherini, High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. The chemical attack occurred just as peace talks were beginning in Geneva, and with the Syrian army in a dominant position in the sixth year of a war fueled by outside powers. The attacks threatened to reverse the political gains made by the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, leading to unrelenting bipartisan pressure for Donald Trump to authorize a bombing campaign targeting the Syrian government and its military. For the al-Qaeda-allied rebels who were ousted from their stronghold in eastern Aleppo in December of 2016, and whose gains in a recent series of offensives have been rapidly reversed, Western military intervention is the only hope for victory. Given its dominant position, why would the Syrian government authorize a chemical attack that was likely to trigger renewed calls for regime change? The answer remains elusive. But there has been one issue major media outlets have refused to touch, and that is the nature of the rebels who would gain from any U.S. military offensive. Who holds power in Idlib, IDLIB? Why are they there? And what do they want? This is perhaps the most inconvenient set of questions for proponents of, quote, humanitarian, unquote, military intervention in Syria. The reality is that Idlib is substantially controlled by al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, which has gone through a series of rebranding schemes, but remains the same jihadist group it always was, Jabhat al-Nusra. In the province it rules, al-Nusra has imposed what a leading scholar has described as a Taliban-like regime that has ethnically cleansed religious and ethnic minorities, banned music, and establish a brutal theocracy in which it publicly executes women accused of adultery. Even analysts who have repeatedly called for U.S.-led regime change in Syria have described Idlib as the, quote, heartland of al-Nusra, unquote. When al-Nusra and its ally, Arar al-Sham, took Idlib's Abu al-Duhur airbase in 2015, a cleric appeared on the scene in camouflaged battle dress uniform. Standing among a group of blindfolded, exhausted captives, all Syrian army regulars, the cleric blessed their mass execution, cursing them as takfir for fighting on the government's side. "I don't like to call them Sunni. They were once Sunni, but they became apostatized once they enlisted in the Alawites regime, unquote, he said of the 56 captives. Moments later, they were lined up and riddled with bullets. The cleric was Abdullah Muhassini, M-U-H-A-Y-S-I-N-I, a 33-year-old zealot from Saudi Arabia, who was a student of Suleiman al-Alwan, the Saudi Wahhabi cleric, who oversaw what his Muslim critics have called a terrorist factory in Saudi Arabia's Al-Qassim province. Al-Alwan was also the instructor of the 9/11 hijacker Abdul Aziz al-Omari. Today, Muhassini commands an almost mythical status among the Islamist armed groups rampaging across northern Syria. According to Bilal Abdul Karim, an American-born rebel propagandist currently in Idlib, Muhassini is probably the most loved cleric in the Syrian territories today. Again, the top cleric there, a fellow who blessed the summary execution of 56 prisoners of war. That is, of course, a war crime. He is a student of the same Wahhabi cleric who ministered and was the instructor for Abdul Aziz al-Omari, one of the 9/11 hijackers. I think that puts things into some perspective. A number of things to bear in mind as you watch what is going on in Syria. I don't want to linger too long on this point, but I think that the sort of rush to judgment that we have seen with regard to Syria is very likely to have a domestic component at some point in the future. In the event of another terrorist incident, a major one or perhaps a series of smaller ones in this country, I would not be at all surprised to see the Democrats being demonized as the terrorist lobby and so forth. In, for the record, 953, I expressed my concern that in the background, or in some cases in the foreground of the Bernie Sanders campaign, one sees some of the same figures, such as Karl Rove, former CIA station chief in Kabul, Graham E. Fuller, and Grover Norquist, or at least his protege, Faisal Gill, either moving into the Democratic Party and or weighing in with money and or rhetoric on behalf of Bernie Sanders. Those three people are more identified with the jihadist, pro-jihadist element in the Republican Party, something that emerged as a result, emerged into public, into the light of day, as a result of the Operation Green Quest raids, something that was then covered up. I think that we may very well be seeing the table set for a similar rush to judgment here in the U.S. The Trump administration and indeed the Republicans themselves really have nothing to offer in terms of governance, and at some point that is going to become quite clear to people. When that happens, they are going to be, the citizenry is going to be had, is going to be, as Shakespeare said, speaking through Mark Antony in the tragedy of Julius Caesar, made so familiar with death and the instruments of war that mothers shall but laugh to see their babes halved before their eyes. Cry havoc, therefore, and let slip the dogs of war. That may very well be occurring abroad and at home as well. One of the things that's puzzling, I think, to an awful lot of people is the Orientalism that Muslims, either pro or con, are represented as manifesting in this country. I think rather than the Orientalism, which on the right is a negative Orientalism in which Muslims are seen as Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, bearded cutthroats riding their black Arabian chargers into a cave with scimitars in their teeth and then running their fingers through bags full of stolen gold coins while they cackle in glee. Or in the case of the so-called progressive sector, they're seen as Aladdin sailing in the front door on a magic carpet with a beatific smile on his face, and he rubs his magic lantern and out comes Scheherazade doing a belly dance. A more useful way of thinking of things rather than that, either negative or positive orientalism, both frankly condescending and ignorant in their fundament. A much more useful way rather than thinking, well, Muslims thumbs up or Muslims thumbs down, is to think about the economic component.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Very quickly, speaking of Graham Fuller, when he speaks of Bernie Sanders as he did in an article that is linked from the Consortium News website, Graham Fuller, again, more identified with jihadists than any other major U.S. intelligence officer. Like many others, I have been galvanized at watching the spectacle of Bernie Sanders proclaiming issues in his campaign that had been virtually off limits for political discussion for decades. The gap between rich and poor, rapacious international trade deals, a fair wage, free university education, the calls for U.S. balance in handling the Arab-Israeli issue, etc. The thing that I find so frankly incredible and more than a little suspicious at Graham Fuller's endorsement of Bernie Sanders is that the issues that Bernie Sanders articulated and which have been reinforced here by Graham Fuller are the exact opposite of what Graham Fuller really believes in. In an article from the NSFW Corp publication about Chechnya by Mark Ames, that too is linked in this program, in the written description that will be available for the record, 954. It's called Chechnyan Power by Mark Ames. And again, there's a link in For the Record, in the description for the Record 954. The values that Graham Fuller really believes in are the opposite of those articulated by Graham Fuller, and they are the values of the Muslim Brotherhood and of fundamentalist Wahhabi Islam. Mark Ames writes, Fuller comes from that faction of CIA cult warriors who believed and still apparently believe that fundamentalist Islam, even in its radical jihadi form, does not pose a threat to the West for the simple reason that fundamentalist Islam is conservative, is against social justice, against socialism and redistribution of wealth, and in favor of hierarchical socioeconomic structures. Socialism is the common enemy to both capitalist America and to Wahhabi Islam, according to Fuller. There is no mainstream Islamic organization with radical social views, he wrote, again quoting Fuller. Classical Islamic theory envisages the role of the state as limited to facilitating the well-being of markets and merchants rather than controlling markets and merchants. Islamists have always powerfully objected to socialism and communism. Islam has never had problems with the idea that wealth is unevenly distributed. The point being here that the values that Graham Fuller believes in and the values that have led Graham Fuller to support Wahhabi jihadists, such as we are seeing holding forth in Syria, are the precise antithesis of the values articulated by Bernie Sanders. I don't, as you know, as veteran listeners know, I don't think much at all of Bernie Sanders. I do, however, agree in principle with the vast bulk of the policy positions he has adopted. I also would like to live forever, and the possibilities of both taking place are the same. Zero. the point here, though, Graham Fuller believes in the opposite of what Bernie Sanders believes in. And that is why I find his support for Sanders suspicious. More before we launch into the sarin attack, or alleged sarin attack, and the problems with intelligence in this regard. Another thing to bear in mind, again, with regard to the jihadis and the Muslim Brotherhood parent organization for them, an article from Newsweek of July 3rd through 10th of 2006. It's an article by Stephen Glaim, G-L-A-I-N, Islam in Office, skipping down. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun as its economic guide. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. Again, something to bear in mind when one sees Islamic fascists being supported either militarily or politically by elements allied with either our national security establishment or the transnational corporate community. Bear in mind that even though American combat personnel have been engaged against some of those Islamists, rather like American troops engaged against fascists in World War II, the fact of the matter is that powerful corporate interests like the economic policies of the Muslim Brotherhood, again, an Islamic fascist organization allied with the Axis in World War II, that then jumped to Western intel at the end of the war, the CIA in particular. Again, something to bear in mind. Why would we want to support the al-Nusra Front, as brutal as they are? Well, bearing in mind what the jihadis and the Wahhabis and the Muslim Brotherhood believe in terms of economic theory, it is not as puzzling as I think it might be at first glance. Something else to remember, and this, by the way, should be very carefully understood, there is no evidence whatsoever that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September 11th attacks. However, there was a prospective relationship between al-Qaeda and the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. And what it was a doomsday backup scenario, the thrust of it being that with both Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda ranged against the U.S., if either of them was done in, then the other was to act as something of a backup unit. In particular, al-Qaeda was to be receiving information and technology for the production of chemical and biological weapons from Saddam Hussein in the event that the U.S. were to knock Saddam Hussein out of the box. So, of course, that is what happened. Reviewing briefly from In the Name of Osama Bin Laden by Romain Jacquard, J-A-C-Q-U-A-R-D, copyright 2002, Duke University Press, in softcover. It appears, however, that this version is the publicly admissible one, one that can pass political muster. According to the same sources, there was another scenario more. In keeping with the calculating mentality of Saddam Hussein and his secret services, in 1998, after declining all offers that had been made to them through the official diplomatic channels, those services are reported to have established a secret operational connection, unquote, with bin Laden in Manila and in Kashmir. It was indeed difficult for Iraq to ignore an Arab like Osama bin Laden, who so effectively humiliated the Americans. Colonel Khairullah al-Takriti. The brother of the head of the Mukhabarat, the intelligence services, is reported to have been named case officer for the al-Qaeda connection. And then skipping down, according to Western sources, the Iraqi services have sought to secure the assistance of bin Laden's networks in case Iraq were again to be attacked by the U.S. in order to carry out attacks against American targets in Arab countries. According to Arab sources, in anticipation of a foreseeable reversal of alliances in Kabul, bin Laden had been in discreet contact since September of 2000 with associates of Uday Hussein, another of Saddam's sons. The ground for agreement was the anti-Israeli and anti-American battle. Bin Laden and the Iraqis are said to have exchanged information about chemical and biological weapons, despite the opposition of some of the Baghdad leadership, including Tariq Aziz. The point being that there was, although there certainly was no involvement of Saddam Hussein in the September 11th attacks, Condoleezza Rice and Company's statements to the contrary notwithstanding, there was a backup agreement in the event that the U.S. knocked Saddam Hussein out of the box, and of course we did. Then there was assistance to be given to the al-Qaeda cadre, including information about chemical and biological weapons. In past broadcasts dealing with ISIS, we have noted that among the reasons for the relative battlefield proficiency of ISIS is the fact that many of their officers are former officers in the Iraqi army, who after the defeat of Saddam Hussein's forces by the U.S. then went to work for ISIS. It may very well be that some of the, and we will talk about this, the documented chemical and biological warfare capability of various al-Qaeda branches, including the Nusra Front in Iraq, may have had this as something of a genesis point. Something else to bear in mind. With now the prospect of more war in the Middle East, not only are defense stocks going up, but oil stocks are going up as well. The price of oil is going up, as it always does when there is war and or the threat of war in the Middle East, because, of course, that raises questions about the availability of oil in the event that the war really gets going. From the Wall Street Journal of July 24th of 2006 by Karen Richardson and Yasmin El-Rashidi, Mideast stocks hold up well amid conflict. And this was during the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel. Skipping down, Lebanon is far away, says Waleed Abdullah, a sales manager in Sharjah, one of the United Arab Emirates, who has been buying stocks in neighboring Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Our investments here aren't affected really by what happens there. For investors like Mr. Abdullah, conflict in the Middle East means one thing: higher oil prices. It's always good for us, he says. Again, these last two sentences. For investors like Mr. Abdullah, conflict in the Middle East means one thing: higher oil prices. It's always good for us, he says. The U.S. Secretary of State, of course, is Rex Tillerson, who was the former CEO for ExxonMobil. That is the largest American oil company. So keep all of those things in mind as one sees what is going on in the Middle East.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, with regard to the latest alleged attack, and there is no critical distance on this in most American media presentations. And the Democrats are joining with the Republicans, by and large, in cheering this on. And I would note that the attempts at undermining Trump because of his alleged connection, Kremlin connection, the Putin connection, etc., those are basically blown out of the water at this point. So Trump has helped himself politically as well. In terms of helping you sleep at night, just keep this in mind. It looks like one of the major influences on Trump's decision to launch cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase was Ivanka Trump, who now has a security clearance, and along with her husband, Jared Kushner, 2 years her senior, is their major forces in the Trump White House. Neither of them has any political experience, neither, for that matter, does Donald Trump. And the combined age of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner is 70 years old. But Ivanka Trump appears to have been one of the dominant influences in getting her father to attack Syria. One wonders if the escalation continues. Maybe they'll have some B-52s drop designer handbags and shoes on Syrian military emplacements. Those to be provided by, of course, Ivanka Trump. With regard to the attack itself, one of the very few news sources that has presented information at variance with the official version is Consortium News, presided over by Robert Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. On April 7th, Consortium News featured Trump's Wag the Dog moment by Robert Perry. It reads in part about the intelligence with regard to the attack. There is also an internal dispute over the intelligence. On Thursday night, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the U.S. intelligence community assessed with a high degree of confidence, unquote, that the Syrian government had dropped a poison gas bomb on civilians in Idlib province. But a number of intelligence sources have made contradictory assessments, saying the preponderance of evidence suggests that al-Qaeda-affiliated rebels were at fault, either by orchestrating an intentional release of a chemical agent as a provocation, or by possessing containers of poison gas that ruptured during a conventional bombing raid. One intelligence source told me that the most likely scenario was a staged event by the rebels intended to force Trump to reverse a policy announced only days earlier, that the U.S. government would no longer seek regime change, unquote, in Syria, and would focus on attacking the common enemy, Islamic terror groups that represent the core of the rebel forces. Skipping down. Alarm within the U.S. intelligence community about Trump's hasty decision to attack Syria reverberated from the Middle East back to Washington, where former CIA officer Philip Giraldi, G-I-R-A-L-D-I, reported hearing from his intelligence contacts in the field that they were shocked at how the new poison gas story was being distorted by Trump and the mainstream U.S. media. Giraldi told Scott Horton's webcast, quote, I'm hearing from sources on the ground in the Middle East, people who are intimately familiar with the intelligence that is available, who are saying that the essential narrative that we're all hearing about the Syrian government or the Russians using chemical weapons on innocent civilians is a sham, unquote. Giraldi said his sources were more in line with an analysis postulating an accidental release of the poison gas after an al-Qaeda arms depot was hit by a Russian airstrike. Quote, the intelligence confirms pretty much the account that the Russians have been giving, which is that they hit a warehouse where the rebels, now these rebels that are, of course, connected with al-Qaeda, where the rebels were storing chemicals of their own, and it basically caused an explosion that resulted in the casualties. Apparently, the intelligence on this is very clear, unquote. Giraldi said the anger within the intelligence community over the distortion of intelligence to justify Trump's military retaliation was so great that some covert officers were considering going public. People in both the agency, the CIA, and in the military who are aware of the intelligence are freaking out about this because essentially Trump completely misrepresented what he already should have known, but maybe he didn't. And they're afraid that this is moving toward a situation that could easily turn into armed conflict, Giraldi said before Thursday night's missile strike. They are astonished by how this is being played by the administration and by the U.S. media. Indeed, I think that speaks for itself. Another Robert Perry article from Consortium News, this one from April 8th of 2017. Where was the CIA's Pompeo on Syria? I'm simply going to sum this up. It makes the point that in a photograph, a widely circulated photograph of Donald Trump sitting down with his brain trust and talking about the Syria strike, not only CIA Director Pompeo, but also the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, and really no major U.S. intelligence official was in that picture. And Perry knows that that is very unusual. And in his opinion, that is indicative of the fact that there is a, as Philip Giraldi indicated, there is widespread disagreement within the intelligence community itself about just who was responsible for the alleged sarin release. Of another interesting aspect of the imbroglio concerns withholding of evidence. And one of the things that Perry points out, Robert Perry, and yet another Consortium News article, was that the evidence that clearly implicated Syria, et cetera, has actually been withheld. And the key parts of it have been withheld. Part of this article, Trump withholds Syria sarin evidence. A four-page white paper prepared by President Trump's National Security Council staff and released by the White House on Tuesday claimed that U.S. intelligence has proof that the plane carrying the sarin gas left from the Syrian military airfield that Trump ordered hit by Tomahawk missiles on April 6th. The paper asserted that, quote, we have signals intelligence and geospatial intelligence, unquote, but then added that, quote, we cannot publicly release all available intelligence on this attack due to the need to protect sources and methods, unquote. One of the possible scenarios that apparently is being weighed by intelligence analysts in this country, and you would never know that to read most of the media, and that is the possibility that a drone may have actually conducted the chemical weapons attack, and that the deploying of the drone and the chemical weapons was a provocation. Again, from Trump withholds Syria sarin evidence by Robert Perry, skipping down. In the case of the April 4th chemical weapons incident in the town of Khan Sheikhoun, which reportedly killed scores of people, including young children, I was told that initially the U.S. analysts couldn't see any warplanes over the area in Idlib province at the suspected time of the poison gas attack, but later they detected a drone that they thought might have delivered the bomb. According to a source, the analysts struggled to identify whose drone it was and where it originated. Despite some technical difficulties in tracing its flight path, analysts eventually came to believe that the flight was launched in Jordan from a Saudi Israeli special operations base for supporting Syrian rebels, the source said, adding that the suspected reason for the poison gas was to create an incident that would reverse the Trump administration's announcement in late March that it was no longer seeking the removal of President Bashar al-Assad. If indeed that was the motive, and if the source's information is correct, the operation would have been successful, since the Trump administration has now reversed itself and is pressing Russia to join in ousting Assad, who is getting blamed for the latest chemical weapons incident. And skipping down into the article, talking about various scenarios and what they can indicate. On April 6th, before Trump's missile strike, I and others received word from U.S. military intelligence officials in the Middle East that they too shared the belief that the poison gas may have resulted from a conventional bombing raid that ruptured containers stored by the rebels who, in Idlib province, are dominated by al-Qaeda's affiliate and its allies. Those reports were cited by former U.S. intelligence officials, including more than two dozen who produced a memo to President Trump urging him to undertake a careful investigation of the incident before letting this crisis exacerbate U.S.-Russia relations. The memo said our U.S. Army contacts in the area, unquote, were disputing the official story of a chemical weapons attack, quoting, instead, a Syrian aircraft bombed an al-Qaeda in Syria ammunition depot that turned out to be full of noxious chemicals, and a strong wind blew the chemical-laden cloud over a nearby village, where many consequently died, the memo said. In other words, to suggest possible alternative scenarios, as the Russians had done, is not evidence of a cover-up, unquote, even if the theories are later shown to be erroneous. It is the normal process of sorting through often conflicting initial reports. And skipping down, in a separate analysis of the four-page dossier, Theodore Postol, P-O-S-T-O-L, a national security specialist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, concluded that the White House claims were clearly bogus, writing, quote, I have reviewed the document carefully, and I believe it can be shown without doubt that the document does not provide any evidence whatsoever that the U.S. government has concrete knowledge that the government of Syria was the source of the chemical attack in Khan Shaykhun, Syria, at roughly 6 to 7 a.m. on April 4th, 2017. In fact, a main piece of evidence that is cited in the document points to an attack that was executed by individuals on the ground, not from an aircraft, on the morning of April 4th. This conclusion is based on an assumption made by the White House when it cited the source of the sarin release and the photographs of that source. My own assessment is that the source was very likely tampered with or staged, so no serious conclusion could be made from the photograph cited by the White House. Unquote. To give us some perspective on the current situation, and I can see that we're going to have to continue some of this analysis in another program. There's so many things I want to get to, and unfortunately, events keep unfolding. So we're certainly going to have to continue with this analysis in another program.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
However, in terms of giving us some perspective, back in 2013, there was a sarin attack in Syria, and we were all being told that, yes, this was the Assad government, and it almost led Barack Obama and then Secretary of State John Kerry into upping the ante military-wise in Syria. It turns out that it was not Assad who produced the sarin, but it was the rebels, and that they may very well have been assisted by Turkey. The source of the contradiction of what was then the official narrative was none other than Seymour Hersh, the famed investigative reporter, best known for his expose of My Lie. However, Hirsch could not get this in an American media source. He had to publish this in the London Review of Books from April 17th of 2014. This is called The Red Line and The Rat Line. The red line refers to Obama's red line that should not be crossed, i.e. using chemical weapons. And the rat line refers to a conduit to arm the rebels that was set up running through Turkey. Skipping down. Obama's change of mind had its origins at Porton Down, the defense laboratory in Wiltshire. British intelligence had obtained a sample of the sarin used in the August 21st, 2013 attack, and analysis demonstrated that the gas used did not match the batches known to exist in the Syrian Army's chemical weapons arsenal. The message that the case against Syria wouldn't hold up was quickly relayed to the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The British report heightened doubts inside the Pentagon. The Joint Chiefs were already preparing to warn Obama that his plan for a far-reaching bomb and missile attack on Syria's infrastructure could lead to a wider war in the Middle East. As a consequence, the American officers delivered a last-minute caution to the president, which, in their view, eventually led to his canceling the attack. For months, there had been acute concern among senior military leaders and the intelligence community about the role in the war of Syria's neighbors, especially Turkey. Prime Minister Recep Erdogan was known to be supporting the al-Nusra Front, a jihadist faction among the rebel opposition, as well as other Islamist rebel groups. We knew there were some in the Turkish government, a former senior U.S. intelligence official who has access to current intelligence told me, who believed they could get Assad's, I can't use that word, in a vice by dabbling with a sarin attack inside Syria and forcing Obama to make good on his red line threat. The Joint Chiefs also knew that the Obama administration's public claims that only the Syrian army had access to sarin were wrong. The American and British intelligence communities had been aware since the spring of 2013 that some rebel units in Syria were developing chemical weapons. On June 20th, analysts for the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency issued a highly classified five-page talking points briefing for the DIA's Deputy Director, David Shedd, S-H-E-D-D, which stated that al-Nusra maintained a sarin production cell. Its program, the paper said, was the most advanced sarin plot since al-Qaeda's pre-9/11 effort. Parenthetically, recall the passage from In the Name of Osama bin Laden about the contingency doomsday plan set up whereby, in the event that Saddam Hussein was knocked out of the box by the Americans, which of course happened, then information about production of chemical and biological weapons would be communicated to al-Qaeda. And the Nusra Front is al-Qaeda in Iraq when they are in Syria, and that it is al-Nusra Front territory that in which the alleged attack took place, and they also are in possession of sarin. Beginning again with this point. On the 20th of June, analysts for the U.S. DIA issued a highly classified five-page talking points briefing for the DIA's Deputy Director, David Shedd, which stated that al-Nusra maintained a sarin production cell. Its program, the paper said, was the most advanced sarin plot since al-Qaeda's pre-9/11 effort. According to a Defense Department consultant, U.S. intelligence has long known that al-Qaeda experimented with chemical weapons and has a video of one of its gas experiments with dogs. The DIA paper went on, previous intelligence community focus had been almost entirely on Syrian chemical weapons stockpiles. Now we see a Nusra Front attempting to make its own chemical weapons. Al-Nusra Front's relative freedom of operation within Syria leads us to assess the group's CW aspirations will be difficult to disrupt in the future. The paper drew on classified intelligence from numerous agencies, again quoting, Turkey and Saudi-based chemical facilitators, it said, were attempting to obtain sarin precursors in bulk, tens of kilograms, likely for the anticipated large-scale production effort in Syria. Asked about the DIA paper, a spokesperson from the Director of National Intelligence said, no such paper was ever requested or produced by intelligence community analysts, unquote. Last May, more than 10 members of the al-Nusra Front were arrested in southern Turkey in what local police told the press were 2 kilograms of sarin. In a 130-page indictment, the group was accused of attempting to purchase fuses, piping for the construction of mortars, and chemical precursors for sarin. 5 of those arrested were freed after a brief detention. The others, including the ringleader Haytham Kassab, Q-A-S-S-A-B, for whom the prosecutor requested a prison sentence of 25 years, were released pending trial. In the meantime, the Turkish press has been rife with speculation that the Erdogan administration has been covering up the extent of its involvement with the rebels. In the news conference last summer, Edin Sezgin, S-E-Z-G-I-N, Turkey's ambassador to Moscow, dismissed the arrests and claimed to reporters that the recovered sarin was merely antifreeze, unquote. The DIA paper took the arrests as evidence that al-Nusra was expanding its access to chemical weapons. It said Kassab had self-identified as a member of the al-Nusra Front and that he was directly connected to Abed el-Ghani, the ANF emir for military manufacturing. ANF is the Nusra Front. Kassab and his associate Khalid Usta, O-U-S-T-A, work with Halit Unalkaya, U-N-A-L-K-A-Y-A, an employee of a Turkish firm called Zurvey Export, who provided price quotes for bulk quantities of sarin precursors. Abed El-Ghani's plan was for 2 associates to, quote, perfect a process for making sarin, then to go to Syria to train others to begin large-scale production at an unidentified lab in Syria. The DIA paper said that one of his operatives had purchased a precursor on the Baghdad chemical market, which, quote, has supported at least 7 chemical warfare efforts since 2004. Once again, the DIA paper said that one of his operatives had purchased a precursor on the Baghdad chemical market, which, quote, has supported at least 7 CW efforts since 2004. Again, the contingency doomsday plan set up whereby if Saddam Hussein was knocked out of the box, they would communicate CBW technology and perhaps hardware as well to Al-Qaeda should be borne in mind here. Continuing with Hirsch's text, a series of chemical weapons attacks in March and April of 2013 was investigated over the next few months by a special UN mission to Syria. A person with close knowledge of the UN's activity in Syria told me that there was evidence linking the Syrian opposition to the first gas attack on the 19th of March in Khan al-Assal, a village near Aleppo. In its final report in December, the mission said that at least 19 civilians and 1 Syrian soldier were among the fatalities, along with scores of injured. It had no mandate to assign responsibility for the attack, but the person with knowledge of the UN's activities said, quote, investigators interviewed the people who were there, including the doctors who treated the victims. It was clear that the rebels used the gas. It did not come out in public because no one wanted to know, unquote. In the months before the attacks began, a former senior Defense Department official told me the DIA was circulating a daily classified report known as SIRIP, all in capital letters, on all intelligence related to the Syrian conflict, including material on chemical weapons. But in the spring, distribution of the part of the report concerning chemical weapons was severely curtailed on the orders of Dennis McDonough, the White House chief of staff. Something was in there that triggered a S-blank-blank-blank fit by McDonough, the former Defense Department official said. One day it was a huge deal, and then after the March and April sarin attacks, he snapped his fingers. It's no longer there. The decision to restrict distribution was made as the Joint Chiefs ordered intensive contingency planning for a possible ground invasion of Syria, whose primary objective would be the elimination of chemical weapons. Skipping down. At this stage, Obama's premise that only the Syrian army was capable of deploying sarin was unraveling. Within a few days of the August 21st, 2013 attack, the former intelligence official told me, Russian military intelligence operatives had recovered samples of the chemical agent from Ghouta. They analyzed it and passed it on to British military intelligence. This was the material sent to Portendown. A spokesman for Portendown said, many of the samples analyzed in the UK tested positive for the nerve agent sarin. MI6 says that it doesn't comment on intelligence matters. The former intelligence official said the Russian who delivered the sample to the UK was, quote, a good source, someone with access, knowledge, and a record of being trustworthy, unquote. After the first reported uses of chemical weapons in Syria last year, American and allied intelligence agencies made an effort to find the answer to what, if anything, was used and its source, the former intelligence official said. We used data exchange as part of the Chemical Weapons Convention. The DIA's baseline consisted of knowing the composition of each batch of Soviet-manufactured chemical weapons, but we didn't know which batches the Assad government currently had in its arsenal. Within days of the Damascus incident, we asked a source in the Syrian government to give us a list of the batches the government currently had. This is why we could confirm the difference so quickly. The process hadn't worked as smoothly in the spring, the former intelligence official said, because the studies done by Western intelligence were inconclusive as to the type of gas that it was. The point being, as Hirsch writes, skipping down, the UK defense staff who relayed the Portendown findings to the Joint Chiefs were sending the Americans a message, the former intelligence official said. We're being set up here. Skipping down again. By then, the attack was, that is a joint U.S., British, and French attack on Syria. By then, the attack was a few days away, and American, British, and French planes, ships, and submarines were at the ready. And so the point being that when an alleged Assad government sarin attack in 2013 was analyzed, it turned out that the sarin used was not the type of sarin that was in the possession of the Syrian government. And it is known that the al-Nusra Front did indeed not only have sarin gas, but was in the process of securing precursor chemicals for its broader construction. We can continue with this analysis because there's still a lot to talk about. In our next program, however, we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record 954. Syrian chemical attack, not so fast, being recorded on April 13th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.